Welcome to Thrive Deeper, the show based on the Thrive Bible reading guides. This is an ongoing conversation about God's Word with Thrive author, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
Well, good morning, Matt.
Morning.
Back from a short trip to Tasmania.
Yeah.
And a late night last night, so we'll see how you go this morning, eh?
It's an unusual one today, Stu,
it is.
Isn't it?
It is an odd one, the Song of Songs or the Song of Solomon. And welcome, listeners. Great to have you with us with Thrive Deeper. Yeah, Matt, it is an odd one. And as I read through the book again, it's kind of hard not to ask the question, what on earth is this doing in the middle of the Bible? There's no mention of God or covenant or law or Israel's history or pointing.
Yeah,
it doesn't seem to be anything pointing forward to Jesus. It almost feels just like a bit of erotic poetry right in the middle of the Bible, just to kind of break it up a bit. You know, here's the halftime break.
Yeah. Okay, let's see if we can imbue it with a little more significance than that. Well, I mean, this is an interesting issue, isn't it? Because I guess one question is why not? And as I thought about this, I thought about the way in our culture we tend to segment life.
Yeah.
There's spiritual things. And then there's sort of other things. And it's not to, in any way, you know, obliterate the idea that, yes, some things are sacred and some things are profane. But, you know, there's still something problematic about that, the way that we segment life up like that. And this is a piece of ancient writing. This is ancient poetry. Mm. Bruce celebrating love, yep. and it belongs in the biblical tradition, right? It's
yes.
in the Hebrew. It belongs alongside the other writings. You know, I mean, probably, and we'll say a bit more about this, but probably around the same time as Proverbs, and belonging probably to the time of Solomon. I'll say why. You know, I think there's a good case for that. And, you know, that was a time of artistic flourishing and, you know, lots of cultural things happening during that time. It was a bit of a golden age for art and culture under Solomon's kingdom. And so these, love poems exist in that ancient world. I mean, we've discovered love poems from different cultures around Israel, and this is using similar imagery and forms. And so it's just included here because it belongs to that era, and it's seen to say something important about what is one of the most prominent parts of life, which is romantic sexual relationships. So again, I come back to the question, well, why not? Because this is such a big part of life, and this is celebrating that big part of life. Does it need to mention God, or does it need to have what we would perhaps think of it as a explicit theological message in order for it to be justified? Now, there has been a school of thought that has felt, well, it does need to have that, and so we'll see it as an allegory. And so the, you know, allegorical interpretations have been quite popular, and so this is about Christ and the church and so forth. That, I think, comes out of this sense that, well, the Bible wouldn't just have a book about love and romantic relationships.
There's almost
a kind of Platonism at work, those fleshly sort of things that all belongs to the physicality and sensuality, and that's got nothing to do. You know, there's nothing spiritual about that. But I think that's a problem.
But I think that's the point as well, maybe. Because you say, this belongs here, but then there's probably hundreds of other writings that could, under that pretext, belong here as well from a similar time. Traditional biblical writings. But this is in here. And I wondered whether, in fact, talking about the Plato thing there, whether, in fact, this is actually trying to say something about God's view of embodiment, about, the desire and relational intimacy, and the fact that it's not something we should be ashamed of. It's not something we should try to pass aside as just a necessary kind of evil, for want of a better word. But it's actually something God wants us to celebrate.
That's right. I would take this book as exactly that, as a celebration and an affirmation of physical and romantic love. And so I think that's a topic that is absolutely worthy of celebration. It's worthy of being in the Bible. It's such a prominent part of life. And the book actually has a significant message about that. And we'll get to that in a moment. I think it's saying some important things, even quite countercultural things for the time, about romantic love and sexuality. So it does actually have a message. And we'll get to that. But first of all, In terms of the when and the who of this book, I think it's worth saying a few things about that, Stu. As I said, this kind of poetry, this is very poetic. So this is poetry through and through. And this is partly why, you know, there's a strong, as well as the fact that it begins with Solomon's Song of Songs. Okay, so the question then is there any reason to doubt that it belongs to the period of Solomon? Now, when it says Solomon's Songs of Songs, you know, these are songs of Solomon. It's a little bit like when the Psalms in the traditional inscriptions in the Psalms, when they say a Psalm of David.
Yes.
Like that could easily mean that it belongs to a collection of David or to the, even perhaps about David or reflects, you know, a period in David's life. It's a way of referring to a collection. Mm. Now, this may be the case here that this is not necessarily written by Solomon. In fact, it actually looks in a lot of cases that it's written in another voice.
Okay.
Solomon, you know, perhaps could be a character in this in a way. One, you know, interesting suggestion, and you know, I think that this has supporters, is that this was actually written by a female courtesan, because most of this book actually is in the female voice.
Yes, which is one of the unusual things I noted.
Yeah.
It's really the woman taking the lead a lot of the, initiating the conversation and taking the lead a lot of the time.
Yeah, so it's quite, that's quite a popular view to see a female author behind these songs.
I think the other thing, perhaps, Matt, and I read it this way, Song of Songs, is kind of like saying, this is the song of all of the songs. In other words, this is the ultimate song. Is it possible that someone like Solomon, and you used the example of the Psalms with David, had people who worked for them who wrote stuff? And so in a sense, even though Solomon himself maybe didn't write it, it was one of his, as you say, writers or courtesans or someone who...
I think that is absolutely possible. And in a culture that's a little less, probably quite a lot less concerned about authorship than we are, you know, in the days of copyright and so forth. So I don't think they had that level of concern. It belonged to
his collection,
his collection or his court. In a way, it comes out of the court of Solomon, or I mean, even the environment that he creates at the time. And we know that there were guilds of musicians, and there were probably guilds of poets and writers and so forth that were attached to the court of Solomon. This, you know, could have come from that. And this brings me actually to one of the really good arguments for supporting, you know, a time of Solomon, that Solomon isn't just a character that is used here, you know, that this is perhaps written way later, and that first verse, Solomon's Song of Songs, is, you know, perhaps just a subsequent author later on referring back or sort of posting this in the time of Solomon as a sort of creative framing device. I think there is actually good reason to see that this actually does come out of Solomon's courts. And it's from what I said before, because this sort of work, like this kind of poetry, generally comes out of periods when there is actually the leisure and the wealth for a sort of cultural flourishing. And I think this collection of poems, and it is a collection of poems, it's not just one poem. I think this collection of poems does reflect a fairly rich cultural context.
Yeah.
Would allow for this kind of poetry.
Totally. We know from 1 Kings 4:32 where it tells us there Solomon's songs numbered 1,005.
Yeah.
You know, so clearly prolific in terms of literature and poetry and songs.
Yeah, that's right. And so that it's not necessarily just songs that he wrote, but in the context that he created in the court, he, you know, he was a great sponsor of these artistic pursuits and so forth.
Let me just say then, before you move off that, somewhat of an irony of here's a guy who's married to I don't know how many women, you know, how many wives he had at the end. And this feels very much like unique one-on-one love, not one of hundreds, you know.
Well, this is scholarly discussions about this book and about the authorship of this book. I mean, one suggestion is that, you know, this belongs to early in his reign.
Right.
You know, that's one suggestion that's been made. Another suggestion is that this goes the other way, where this is sort of towards the end, but he's decided, you know, a little bit like what we may say about Ecclesiastes in some sense, you know, is Solomon reflecting back, if it's written subsequently, it's creating this character, Solomon, that sort of looks back. It's a reflection, subsequent reflection on the life of Solomon.
Yeah.
And one suggestion for the authorship of this is that, you know, this is Solomon who has fallen in love with this Shulamite girl. Mm. We don't really know who this is, but she's a character in this. She's the key sort of female character in this. And, you know, he's decided, no, you know, monogamous love is absolutely the way to go. Now, the one problem I have with that is that then it's basically saying, he's right, that's it. This is, you know, monogamous, you know, love. This is the one.
Yeah.
What is this, the 700?
Yeah, that's
700.
Right. Yeah.
After 700, you know, wives and 300 concubines.
Yeah.
No, this is the one. I think that's, I feel like that's a little bit of a tall order.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, whatever the case, though, and this brings us to the message of the book, it certainly is celebrating monogamous love. Mm. And so, if anything, I think it certainly does stand as a corrective, not only to polygamy, but to what is inferred in Solomon's polygamy. And remember, polygamy was very common.
Yes.
In that world, in that time. Marriages were generally made for pragmatic reasons, so it was invariably transactional.
Yeah.
Particularly marriage in higher levels of society were very pragmatic. Most of Solomon's marriages would have been basically ways of sealing contracts
with other nations,
with other nations or
rulers, whatever,
nobility or whatever. So, in Solomon's case, his 700 wives represented, you know, these contracts or alliances, and so it was a sign of power and wealth. And you know, that kind of transactional love is actually largely what this book is warning against.
Yes.
So I think that's a big part of the message of this book. And I think this is borne out somewhat, Stu, in a repeated statement, which if you've got it there, I'll get to read in chapter 2, verse 7. And this is a statement that's repeated. It's funny because it's not, I mean, perhaps in true poetic fashion, the message isn't sort of thrown in your face. You have to,
yeah,
you sort of have to draw this from the text. But certainly this repeated statement, I think, goes a long way.
Yeah. Chapter 2, verse 7, it says, young women of Jerusalem, and repeatedly those are the ones she is addressing. Yep. This is the woman speaking. I charge you by the gazelles and the wild does of the field, do not stir up or awaken love until the appropriate time.
Yeah, and I think from the context of the book, and as I said, that's a repeated statement, there is a sort of a rigor and a commitment that love requires. That if you're not ready for it, don't go there. It's you know, warning against something impulsive, something transactional, something that is, whatever it is, those approaches to love are, you know, incommensurate with what love actually is. I mean, it's a very powerful, powerful thing, and you shouldn't mess with it. It's going to cause problems. If you try to awaken it or make it happen before it is actually true,
yes,
and found to be true,
yeah,
as in true love.
And so the difference and I know between infatuation or just desire,
yeah,
and actual love as well.
Yeah, so don't, you know, run off with,
yes,
with the first person that you have an infatuation with, yeah, or like treat love with the gravity that it deserves.
Mm.
And if you go right up to the end of the book, you know, there's another poem there at the end of the book, which I think also underscores the overall message of the book. And it's using typical sort of poetic devices. I mean, one interesting thing about this book is the way that it uses fairly common poetic devices from the time, you know, because we can compare this to other love poetry and you know, love poetry was around at the time and we have plenty to compare it to. And, you know, similar sort of imagery going on here, which is partly why that itself actually is strong evidence for the fact that this was never meant to be an allegory, because it's using similar devices to what clearly was actually love poetry, a celebration of love, of sexual and romantic love in other cultures. This is using, you know, similar devices from that. And so it's partly why we know, no, this is actually a celebration of sexual and romantic love.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the allegorizing scripture is problematic anyway as a form of interpretation. We need to be very careful with that, because the problem with that is that you can kind of make the text then just say anything that you want.
Yeah.
You know, you know, it's not to say that there aren't sometimes sort of double meanings or, you know, things like that, but it has to be evident from the text itself that that's the case.
Mm.
So that poetic kind of approach we see here already with the imagery that's used in, you know, verse 5. So it says here, you know, who is this coming up from the wilderness leaning on her beloved? And it goes on to say, under the apple tree I roused you. There your mother conceived you. There she who is in labor gave you birth. And the apple tree is quite a common ancient symbol for romantic and particularly sexual love. It's perhaps a tactful way of talking about sexuality. You know, this is connected. There's almost like the sense, you know, there your mother conceived you. It's in this, you know, out of this sort of romantic love, you know, you were conceived. And so this is a precious and I would say sacred thing.
Yes. You know? Yeah, totally.
And, you know, this idea of the garden, I mean, this is where, you know, these symbols and the idea of the garden, and there is a sense of sacredness attached to that, you know, the idea of the, you know, the apple tree. And in Genesis 2, it talks about the trees in the garden, and we are to picture there a sort of sacred garden.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's a sense throughout this book that sexuality is sacred. And the fact that we have a book of the Bible that celebrates that, I think, puts sexual love in the realm of the sacred.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really important point that flows out of this book, because we, you know, we tend to think there are sacred things and somehow sexuality sits outside of that. You know, it's this sort of profane sort of thing.
Mm.
But actually, no, it's a deeply sacred thing. It's through sexual love that the marriage relationship between a man and a woman is consummated.
Mm-hmm.
And that marriage relationship is an image-bearing thing. I mean, it's a sacred image-bearing thing. The two becoming one and becoming one flesh reflects the image and the glory of God.
Yes.
So what this book, I think, is doing is taking romantic and sexual love, actually taking it from the realm of the profane, where it was often used in profane ways, either to form contracts or just to satisfy immediate desires.
Mm.
I think what this book wants to say is, no, this actually belongs in the realm of the sacred. And so the imagery and the garden imagery is all the way through this, you know, that sexuality is a sacred garden. And so therefore, as I've often said, Stu, if something is sacred, it means you can't just do whatever you want with it. And that, I think, is what that message, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. There is a right time and a place. If something is sacred, there is a right context and a right time and place for it.
Mm.
That is the committed marriage relationship. And so, you know, the message that's repeated through this book, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires, is wanting to take this sacred thing, sexual relationships, and put it in the right context.
Yes.
And so don't mess with this. This is too powerful. This is too sacred for you to treat this in any other way. And I think this is where these verses go on to push that message a little deeper. So verse 6.
Which chapter are you in now, Matt?
I'm in the final
chapter?
Yeah, yep. The final chapter of the book in chapter 8.
Yep.
It says, place me like a seal over your heart. So a seal is a symbol of, it could be a symbol of ownership, but you seal a covenant even, you know, so there's a covenant element to marriage. Seals we use on cylinders, like a kind of stamp of ownership. So, you know, the idea here is that the two, they come to belong to each other.
Okay. Yeah.
And so this is where this is really strongly advocating. Again, not a transactional love, not a love that's just out of impulsive desire, but a love of complete self-giving where the two give themselves to each other. So place me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm. For love is as strong as death. I think it's beautiful imagery, but absolutely appropriate. Love is as strong as death. And I mean, the significance of this too in an ancient world context is death was often personified. You know, Mort, death was in the ancient world was a god. But love is even stronger than the forces of death. It's jealousy unyielding as the grave. And it's interesting. I mean, some translations have passion. What does your translation have?
For love is as strong as death. Ardent love is as unrelenting as Sheol.
Yeah, okay. So it's so your translation is translated ardent love. The word there in other places is translated as jealousy. And basically what that word, and I think actually jealousy is appropriate because, I mean, I like that word there because it helps to give meaning to other places in scripture where God describes himself as being a jealous God. We can tend to think of jealousy in negative ways, but there's a very positive spin on that, that the Bible brings to that idea, because jealousy in this context, and particularly when it talks about God being a jealous God, denotes single-minded devotion to something.
Yes.
It belongs in a covenant context, and I think this is evoking that covenant context where the two form a covenant and they give themselves to each other. And this is where it does connect with, you know, the covenant that God makes with his people, that Christ makes with the church. This is where by analogy, not allegory, but analogy, to be pedantic, that self-giving, that one devotion to the other, the unbreakable nature of that, this word jealousy here is pointing to that strong monogamous two people giving themselves to each other. That couplet there, love is as strong as death, it's jealousy unyielding as the grave. And the second line there, I think, defines the first. You know, it's not just about, yes, love is a powerful thing, but it is something that demands this single-minded approach. It demands faithfulness because it has this covenant aspect. It's the two giving to each other and belonging to each other in a sense. You know, theologically important idea, as I said, because that word is also used of God's love for his people. Mm. It burns like a blazing fire, like a mighty flame. There's something positive there, but something to be wary of. Don't mess with this, right? Yes. It's a very powerful thing. It's a very sacred thing, and therefore it belongs in the context of a devoted covenant relationship because its jealousy is unyielding as the grave.
It's good.
Verse 7, many waters cannot quench love.
So
rivers cannot sweep it away.
Flames, of course, in the previous verse.
Yeah, that's right. And again, the imagery of waters is connected. You know, it's stronger than death in the ancient world. You know, death is associated with the waters. Death and chaos were seen as the sort of strongest imaginable forces in the natural world. But actually, love is stronger than that. Love will outlast those things. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful idea. If one were to give all the wealth of one's house for love, it would be utterly scorned. All right. So again, this is warning against what was very common in those days, which was marriage as a transactional thing. Yes. And that actually was probably the most common way
motivation.
Of using, you know, in using marriage as a way of sort of sealing, you know, financial or political contracts. That should be utterly scorned. I mean, this is saying something really powerful. As I said, it's saying something very countercultural because you're in a context where sex and love and marriage were not actually treated in that way. Mm. But this wants to take that and put it into the context that is articulated beautifully in Genesis chapter 2, Genesis 1 and 2. So what these verses are doing is picking this sacred thing, romantic and sexual love, that has been profaned and putting it back where
it
belongs. That's essentially what this book is doing.
Yeah.
So it's rich stuff, Stu. I mean, I think particularly in our culture, in our cultural context, I think this book is particularly important because on the one hand, it's showing that we absolutely affirm the beauty of romantic and sexual love. It's affirmed. It's not something that we cast aspersions on in any sense as Christians. It's a beautiful thing and it's a gift of God, but it's also a sacred thing.
Yeah.
And because it's a sacred thing, it can't be treated in any way that we want. Because it's a sacred thing, it needs to be treated in the way that God set it apart for and needs to belong within that sacred divine image reflecting relationships that's described in Genesis chapter 2. That is the context that, and it needs to belong within an unyielding lifelong covenant.
Yeah. So kind of what you're saying is much as the rest of the Bible is about God's plan for restoration, this is God's plan for restoration of the unique
monogamous
relationship. That's right. This is how love should be treated.
Yeah, that's right.
Sacred.
Yeah.
not profane.
Yeah, and in the context of a celebration,
yes,
of love.
Yeah,
you know, it's absolutely all the way it's celebration. It's not just a thou shalt not. I mean, that's the way we might easily think about a biblical or a Christian approach to romance and sexuality. You know, it's all about thou shalt nots. But actually, it's not. No, what the Bible has to say about sexual love is primarily a celebration. But because of how wonderful it is, because of how sacred it is, it needs to be treated with the utmost care. And when we treat it that way, we not only honor who we are as human beings, we honor God.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Thrive Deeper. Our home on the internet is thrivetoday.tv. You can contact us, ask questions, see all our resources and much more at our website, thrivetoday.tv. We really appreciate the questions and thoughts about what you're reading as we go through the Bible with Thrive. Until next time, our prayer is that these shows will inspire you to go deeper and thrive.